As I said before, we're going to be spending several Sunday mornings over the next few weeks looking at this book of Exodus, the account of how through Moses God led the Hebrew people from slavery in Egypt to the verge of entering the Promised Land. As the rest of the Old Testament makes clear, the miracle of the Exodus was one of the main reference points in the Israelites' understanding, both about their own identity and, even more importantly, about God. It remains one of the better known parts of the Old Testament, thanks partly to the movies that have been made of it. From the times of Cecil B. DeMille and then Charlton Heston, and again more recently in both live action and animated versions. And as a fan of musicals, I was delighted to see it's been given that treatment as well. It wasn't a big hit, but you can see most of its highlights on YouTube, or if you're really keen, buy the DVD. With no less than 35 musical numbers, including such titles as Drawn from the Water, The Plagues, Let Them Go, Land of Milk and Honey, The Ten, Golden Calf, and many, many, many more. I'm aware that not everyone may share my interest in musicals. I'm even interested in some of those which flop at the box office. But if anyone does decide to buy the DVD, £40 was a bit steep for me. But if anyone does, do lend it to me, and I'd be interested to see it. I was tempted until I saw the YouTube clips, and then that rather put me off. The Bible's account begins before our first reading in telling of the mighty Egyptian Empire's oppression of its Hebrew subjects. You may remember they come to Egypt as honored guests. One of their ancestors, Joseph, had risen to being, as the rather more successful musical put it, Pharaoh's number two. And Joseph's immediate family had been invited to join him in the land. But over the years, it grew to be a clan of what might have been called resident aliens. When I was a student in the States, I had the delightful words F1 alien stamped on my passport as a sign of welcome. More years passed, and the clan became a tribe, which began to be viewed as such a threat that they were compelled into heavy slave labor. And then, even more strictly controlled by a concerted attempt to murder all of their newborn sons. Today, I guess we call it ethnic cleansing. Fortunately, the Hebrew midwives, fearing God more than Pharaoh, allowed as many baby boys as they could to survive. But their Egyptian overlords were on their tails. So when Moses' mother conceived, she tried to hatch a plan to maximize her son's chances of survival. At the age of 3 months, staging a scenario where Pharaoh's daughter stumbled upon what appeared to be an abandoned baby. Moses was never, in fact, abandoned. His sister had been stationed to keep a careful eye on him. And Pharaoh's daughter couldn't resist the crying baby. On to step two of the plan, quite a bold step two. Moses' sister at this point appeared with the suggestion if Pharaoh's daughter wanted to adopt the child, then a suitable Hebrew wet nurse could easily be found to assist the royal household. Of course, it was all very risky. Maybe in Moses' mother's mind, it was really just a long shot, a punt. Even on a calm day, a baby in a basket near to water is a bit of a risk. Then again, Pharaoh's daughter could have been suspicious. Or her father and his advisors might have seen through the plan and swiftly ended young Moses' life. I guess it was a case of desperate times leading to desperate measures, which, of course, all worked a treat. And before long, Moses was established in Pharaoh's household with his mother there to help, initially at least. Though it's hard to be certain of the datings of the book of Exodus's events, most estimates are somewhere between the 13th and the 15th century BC. And that was an era in Egypt that produced the treasures associated with Tutankhamun. They were a very sophisticated and advanced culture. And we presume that Moses would have benefited from one of the finest educations on the planet, as well as learning to speak the right language and developing all the right connections. If anything, the risk would have been that he might simply have been assimilated into the Egyptian court. His Hebrew origins, perhaps no more than a distant connection or maybe even forgotten altogether. The middle of chapter 2 makes clear that even that significant risk didn't develop into a problem. We read that Moses, seeing a fellow Hebrew being ill-treated by an Egyptian, decided to intervene, killing the Egyptian in the end. He thought his act had been unwitnessed and that he'd been able to bury the body unnoticed, but it quickly transpired that Moses had been seen. So he fled to nearby Midian, where he got married and so found a place where he could safely stay. All of which meant he was ready and waiting for the next chapter in the account to unfold, when, of course, God calls Moses to be the leader and rescuer of the Hebrew people. At the end of Exodus chapter 2, the Lord and the Hebrew people's faith in him take center stage. We're told, verse 23, during those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. And that begins to introduce one very important way of seeing the deliverance that happens in the rest of the book of Exodus as an answer to the people's prayer. God heard the cry for help from his chosen people, the descendants of Abraham, and in response to their cry, he acted in the most decisive and amazing ways you could imagine to make sure they were set free from bondage in Egypt. And so in time, God fulfilled his long-standing promise to Abraham to make his people a great nation living in the promised land. What's interesting, though, about the first chapter and a half of the book of Exodus is that the narrator doesn't want a point at that point to be stressing the importance of prayer in that kind of way. Rather, he's emphasizing the way that God was beginning to be at work anyway. He knew that the people needed a leader. He knew that, how should we say, a certain background, a certain training might be helpful if their leader was to be successful in the exit negotiations. And so, long before the time came when the person would be needed, he was preparing not a Theresa May or a Boris Johnson, but a Moses, a Hebrew who'd somehow managed to grow up at the very heart of the enemy's camp as Pharaoh's adopted grandson. It's a bit like when a cuckoo implants her young in another's nest, though as far as we know, in this case, no Egyptian babies needed to be thrown out to make room. If the book of Exodus had been structured differently, and there was talk of the people's cry to God in prayer from the outset, do you see how that could have led to a risk of seeing God as somehow being asleep and unaware of the problem that was developing, or of his needing to be aroused from his slumber by his people's prayers? Some teaching on prayer today almost suggests that's how it works. But though prayer is vital, the emphasis here is on how God delights in working anyway. We mustn't let our teaching on the importance of prayer deny the complementary truth that God is alert and at work in our world. He sees our needs long before we bring them to him in prayer. I'm not sure if we're meant to assume that God specifically implanted the idea for Moses' survival in his mother's mind, or maybe if it was just a rather desperate, even harebrained plan from Moses' family's own imagination. Either way, we see God's hand very definitely at work in the plan's success. And many believers will similarly, as we look back on our lives, detect God at work in very definite ways long before we ever asked him to be. For myself, one specific detail, which might not mean much to anyone else, was the fact that as a teenager, I rather reluctantly opted to study Greek at school. In my mind at the time, it was simply the least bad option, the only way of avoiding one language teacher who I hated and the other who was known to be completely incompetent. 10 years later, as a theological student without much of a bent for languages, I was extremely pleased that in God's providence, I'd already got some way with the Greek when my mind was significantly younger and more able to take it in. Sometimes Christians say there must have been someone praying about the situation, a concerned relative perhaps. And maybe sometimes, maybe even often, that there is. But to assume that there needs to have been someone praying suggests that God is unable to work without that help or that information. And I'm not sure that's a very good way of seeing things. God is more than able to do what's necessary at the right time. At the time of Moses' birth, maybe there were Israelites praying, maybe there weren't. The point is, God can act anyway, and sometimes in extraordinary ways. Quite often in the scriptures, by bringing into the world just the right person at just the right time. Christians, of course, see that happening supremely in Jesus coming to our world. Most Bible students see unmistakable echoes between Exodus chapter 2 and the account of Jesus' origins as recorded in Matthew's Gospel chapter 2. What happens is different. But there are strong common elements, including not only the link with Egypt, but also a capricious ruler who doesn't balk at killing children. And speaking powerfully of the God who is behind what happens to make sure that his people's deliverer not only comes through to tell the tale, but ends up in the right place and the right time, prepared for the task that the Lord has for him. And in Moses' case, we see better equipped to do the job than you could possibly have imagined. A reminder that God sees what's going on in a world, that he sees our needs, and that he is at work. Amen.